I would like, first of all, to express the appreciation of all of us that Professor Ed Frederick from the Wisconsin Lutheran Seminary of Mequon, Wisconsin, has given and shown us the honor of coming on our campus so that we might give him a very, very special welcome and our attentive ear. I am particularly grateful for Professor Frederick's appearance on our campus, not only because he comes from Mequon, Wisconsin, a fellow seminary that we would all, I think, in our hearts yearn to call, in the terminology of historic Lutheranism in America, our sister seminary. His presence, I think, symbolizes over 100 years of very close and intimate fellowship which the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod practiced with the Wisconsin Evangelical Lutheran Synod. But the second reason is equally as compelling, and that is that we have with us one of the great contemporary scholars dealing not only with historical theology in a somewhat longer period of time, but particularly because of his vast knowledge and interest in a study of the Lutheran Confessions, the Lutheran Reformation, and Lutheranism in America. I've known Professor Frederick for any number of years, and during that entire period he has been a scholar and a student of Lutheranism in our country, particularly with reference to what Lutheran confessionalism means today, and also with respect to inter-Lutheran relationships. Professor Frederick was educated at Northwestern College of Watertown, Wisconsin. Some of our colleagues were educated there, the Lutheran Seminary in Mequon, Wisconsin, and did graduate work at Michigan State University. Like so many of us, he comes from a rich pastoral experience in Detroit, Michigan. He served as instructor and principal of a Lutheran high school, was on the faculty of Michigan Lutheran Seminary in Saginaw, Michigan, also at Dr. Martin Luther College of New Ulm, Minnesota, and now since 1971 has been on the faculty of the Mequon Seminary, where he teaches church history, Christian education, and is currently serving as department chairman. But I think he is known far beyond the classroom also because he has been editor and still is serving as editor of the Wisconsin Lutheran Quarterly, a respectable theological journal which has had a history of almost 100 years, if I recall, and I probably should have checked that before making that statement. But it is one of the longest continuing Lutheran theological journals in our country. He's also a contributing editor of the Northwestern Lutheran. I'm particularly happy also to report that he has been, for the past several years, a member of the Board of Directors of the Lutheran Historical Conference. As an essayist, he has given a very renowned testimony, having been one of the speakers at the Congress on Lutheran Confessions, the Bethany Reformation Lectures, and also at various church conventions. I think if you are acquainted with, and if you're not, you ought to take a look at the two series of articles particularly that he has contributed to the Wisconsin Lutheran Quarterly, one on the Wisconsin Synod's interchurch relationship. It's almost a mirror as you look into that series. And the second one, which I think has also been of very great significance during the more contemporary period when we have observed the anniversary of the formula of Concord, his article on the formula in the history of American Lutheranism. And certainly, as I am introducing Professor Frederick this morning, I would like to tell you that we are all certainly anticipating many, many more scholarly articles of that type. The topic that he is presenting has been announced in the brochure which you have received, The Relevance of the Apology Today. And I think that as others who may not be as intimately connected with the Lutheran confessions as you are, you may have wondered just what is the apology and its relevance for today. This is always quite a stumbling question to those who have not been orientated to Lutheran theology. Now, I think misunderstandings sometimes arise, somewhat comparable to the deer hunter. I don't know whether any of you are deer hunters or not. But here was the deer hunter who was on the receiving line as the drivers were bringing the herd past him. And nothing happened. The herd was passed. The drivers saw him as he was leaning against the tree, and they asked him, "What happened? You had several big bucks come through here. What happened to you?" And he said, "Well, it was like this." He said, I took two very good shots, and before I could get the cork back on the bottle, the buck was gone. Now, when the apology is misunderstood, I think that we miss the point totally. However, Professor Frederick this morning is going to speak not only about the apology, but its very, very great relevance for us today. Professor Frederick.
It isn't going to be all that good. Thank you, Dr. Silfo, for those kind and superfluous words. thanks to the Community Life Committee for inviting me here. Thanks to all of you of the Concordia Seminary family for appearing. And thanks to the one member of my family for coming, Mark. I just have to start with this word of appreciation because I have double reason to be thankful for to be invited to present Oswald Reese's lectures on the apology. I've been a fan of both for many years. Back in the late 40s, early 50s, I had the opportunity to serve with Constantine Parish in the Detroit metropolitan area. Pastor Reese was serving in Detroit at that time also. I'm quite sure he wasn't aware of my existence, but I was very much aware of his. Pastor Reese was one of those pastors, the fellow pastors looked up to. At mixed conferences of the synodical conference pastors of the area, his few but very well chosen words carried a lot of wit. And he was professionally admired by the rest of us for his great ability in gathering people for his rapidly growing other tribe Lutheran church. Not only just gathering them, but then instructing them diligently in the saving truth. His manual on adult instruction, What Does the Bible Say, is published proof of that diligent labor. And I count it a privilege to have been able to see living proof of that in those Detroit years. And that's why I'm very thankful for the chance to contribute this little bit to the Oswald Reese lecture series. Then the talk is on the apology of the Augsburg Confession. And he said, I've been a fan of that even longer. Been a fan of the Apology for 42 years, almost to the day. Our symbolic professor, Professor F. Planner, came in the class one day about this time of the year and said that by the end of the quarter, he wanted from every member of the class a detailed outline of the contents of the Apology of the Augsburg Confession. It wasn't the most exciting or imaginative assignment, and I hope your professors be better by you in that respect. It was a Friday morning, I recall that distinctly, and ahead lay a long, dreary weekend. So after lunch, it didn't have much else to do, I thought that maybe it would be a good idea to reconnoiter that assignment and see if there weren't any shortcuts or easy ways out. It didn't work out that way. At all. I started reading a little bit, and it's hard to stop. I know that I did other things that weekend, this Sunday morning at church. I know I did some sleeping, not very much. I did some eating, but I know I didn't eat any breakfast. There's a reason for that. This was school year 1938-39, and that was the year of the beet at our school. You know, the red vegetable. there was a bumper crop that year, and everybody donated bags of beet to our seminary kitchen, and. Times being what they were, we ate what was donated. And we ate beets literally three times a day, 7 days a week. And after about a couple of months of that, I was as sick and tired of eating baked beets, imagine, for breakfast, as I was doing the outline assignment. But in any event, it must have been late Sunday afternoon or early Sunday evening that I finished the assignment and rounded off what I can truthfully say was up to that point the most exciting weekend of my life. Since then, I've had some few that have been more exciting, but not me. And since then, I have been an Apology fan. That sometimes has disadvantages. In a discussion of the theological points that come up in the Augsburg Confession and Apology, such a discussion, most people think and talk from the Augsburg Confession first, and then will only refer to the Apology if necessary. And I often get lost in those discussions because my thinking is always in reverse. I always start with what the Apology says, and then apply that to the Augsburg Confession. I maybe shouldn't say that. I guess that makes me some kind of a theological maverick of sorts. It's not maybe the right way of going at it, but it's the way I do because of that one weekend. More correctly, Melanchthon did that with his theological scholarship to gospel insight. Now these brief introductory remarks are simply pointing out that the assignment to give a reflector, I could call the assignments most appreciated, and the assignment, the first assignment I ever got regarding the apology, an assignment most enjoyable. Talking about putting this in the framework of assignments, 11 years of teaching at a theological seminary, that if there's one thing seminary students react to, even on Monday morning, it's an assignment. And I just thought this might be a good gimmick here. The original apology writer as an assignment to Melanchthon could very well be called assignment impossible. Think of your own classroom. This is hypothetical. It couldn't happen here. Professor walks in the room and starts reading rapidly a 35-page document attacking your religious belief. And then he tells you this has to stand unless successfully refuted, only he will not give you a copy of what he's read to you. You'd say unfair, impossible, and probably even say some worse things than that. But that's just the kind, pretty much the kind of a writing assignment that Melanchthon had at Augsburg in 1530. Maybe his was even more difficult. You recall that whole situation. Finally, the Reformation people were given a chance to speak their piece formally at the Imperial Diet at Augsburg. And on June 25th, they were able to present and have read the Augsburg Confession. Principal writer there, Melanchthon, also. But then the Romans pulled a switch. Instead of presenting a positive statement of their own, they came in with a hastily prepared confutation, simply an attack on what the Augsburg Confession said. After repeated efforts, we finally got a fifth draft, about one-tenth as large as the original, which was, they thought, suitable enough for presentation. Then on August 3rd, they brought in this confutation as the emperor's own answer to the Augsburg Confession, and as the answer that should good man. When they did this, the Lutherans, of course, said, okay, we want to react to that, but they just couldn't get a hold of a copy of the Constitution. The Romans said, oh, we'll give you one, but three conditions. One, you daren't publish the Constitution, you daren't reply to it, you've got to accept it before you take it. Well, obviously, the Reformation people couldn't find their consciences in advance, so they simply had no copy. So Melanchthon's problem was to reply to a document that he hadn't even heard read. It's kind of a mystery. But a letter of Melanchthon says he didn't hear it, and Seckendorf, an early historian, puts that down as a fact, but nobody gives a reason. Melanchthon wasn't known to goof off. There must have been some good reason why he wasn't after reading, but he wasn't. He had a lot of responsibilities, of course. He did have some, of course, information about the Constitution. Notes were taken, honorarios. He was the shorthand expert in the Reformation, who took a lot of notes, gave them to Melanchthon, other people also. I'd like to have that to go on. He also learned more and more about the contents of the Constitution when he served in those committees that were ordered to meet by Emperor Charles to try to find some bridge between the two positions. First, there were 7 19s from each side, and then 3 19s, and Melanchthon worked on those, and thus found out something. The disadvantage of those discussion meetings that they took up all of Melanchthon's time. So almost most of August passed before too much writing could be get done. It wasn't until the end of August, even, that the Reformation estates, princes, cities, actually decided to bring in an official reply to the Constitution. And so then, in September, then Melanchthon really went to work on this writing. He didn't like the job. Melanchthon was a real scholar, dedicated to the canons of scholarship regarding precision and accuracy and thoroughness and fairness. And he just didn't like the idea of this writing against the document that wasn't even in his hand. But he had to do it, and he saved through the job. He tells us at the close of that first draft of the apology, if the Constitution had been forwarded to us for inspection, we would perhaps have been able to give a more adequate answer on this and on other points. He's very courteous there. He could have said a lot more. In any event, after 3 weeks of work, he had a Latin draft ready. This is the Prima Illuminatio, the first draft of the Augsburg, of the Apology to the Augsburg Confession, published 48 years later in the Detroit History of the Augsburg Confession. The reason for the publishing delay, I think you probably know the answer. When that first draft was submitted to Charles on September 22nd as a reply to the Constitution, as a defense of the Augsburg Confession, the Emperor rejected it. A very dramatic moment. This was an imperial session of the Diet. The answer was to be given on the religious question, and the answer would be this. The Augsburg Confession falls. It's been refuted. The Constitution represents the religion of the realm, and the Lutherans have until April 15th to get back in the fold. While these things are being proclaimed, the Lutheran representative, this is the Saxon Chancellor Brick, was, you know, trying to get the floor, claiming, waving a document, saying he had in his hand a writing which showed that the Constitution had not refuted the Augsburg Confession, and he stretched it out to Emperor Charles. And Charles automatically reached out too. And for a moment, history hung in the balance. So, somebody grabbed Charles's hand and pulled it back and explained to him quickly that this thing was all settled. There was no need for any more papers. The Constitution was going to stand. This looked like a very bleak moment for the Reformation forces. In fact, the Elector and Melanchthon and the rest of them packed up and left Augsburg the next day. Really, nothing else can be done. They picked up Coburg. They picked up Luther at the Coburg on the way back. But actually, the way it worked out, it was most fortunate for Melanchthon and for the Lutheran cause that this first draft could be or was rejected. It put the document out there in some kind of a limbo for religious documents that for one or another historic reason had ceased to have function and meaning. And it gave Melanchthon then this wonderful opportunity to do the job the way he would have wanted to do it originally, and come out then with the revised assignment. Melanchthon was also a typical scholar in this, that he's a perfectionist, and he always figured there was maybe a little better way of writing this and saying this. He was constantly tinkering with his own writings and even with the confessions that he provided for the church. And he was very, very eager to get at a revision of the first draft of the Apology. Maybe a little too eager. There are two different versions here, and kind of interesting incident that happened on the way home to Wittenberg from Augsburg in connection with this. You pick out the one you think is right. The more contemporary Matthesius account says they got as far as Altenburg and were at Spalatin's house, and at mealtime they were having a good meal. Only Melanchthon was between bites, was always doing a little more writing, and this finally irritated Luther. And Luther gave Melanchthon a little lecture that the third commandment said that we should have rest and refreshment. And he probably added some fatherless advice about that Melanchthon, above all people, with his nervous stomach and so on, said, watch out for this. But that's one version. The other version, all written in Dolly's Oxford Confession History, has this account that it was on Sunday, and Luther bawled Melanchthon out for not observing the Sabbath properly, writing too much on that day. Well, you can take your pick of the reasons. I got mine picked, but I won't tell you. Then the next fall and winter saw Melanchthon writing like mad on that project of really working on the Apology. Soon after he got back to Wittenberg, he did finally get that constitution copied. Where it came from, it's probably from Nuremberg. The Nuremberg delegation to Augsburg was seemed to be better than the tact than the Wittenberg delegation with these cloak and dagger operations. They were able to send back to Nuremberg a copy of the constitution. Maybe it's because they had Andreas Osiander in their group, and he was he by the way wrote a reply for the constitution also, but Melanchthon doesn't mention it. But evidently he didn't use it much. Melanchthon does say later on the Apology that others helped him, but he doesn't name anyone, and that's probably because He didn't want to incriminate anybody if it later on turned out that writing the apology was a crime that should be punished by death. But that actual copy of the Constitution gave Melanchthon a lot to go on, and he worked hard. When he reached the high point in that writing, and that high point, of course, is when it gets to justification and love and the fulfilling of the law. When he gets to that point, this is what he says in a letter to you. I am revising the apology. It will be much larger, more fully substantiated. At the present time, the article that men are justified by faith rather than by love is being copiously treated. If Christ is our atonement, then it is necessary to understand that we are justified by faith. That justification by love is justification according to the law and not according to the gospel. The gospel puts forth the righteousness of Christ, and the righteousness of the law sets forth another righteousness. When I have finished, I will send it to you. When the writing was completed, Melanchthon, in another letter, could declare confidently, the apology is finished. In it, I think I have treated the articles and repentance, some others, in such a way that the opponents will understand that the burden of proof is placed upon them. In other words, the Augsburg Confession has been defended, it stands, and what Melanchthon says there is something, I think, that should be remembered by us in this day. We're having a lot of desire for discussion between Lutherans and Romans. There was a lot of that last year in connection with the Augsburg Confession. I think there's only one way to approach such a discussion, the way Melanchthon expresses it here. We have stated our position, strong as life and life. The burden of proof is on the other side, rather than if we ought to be in a position of revising and adjusting and so on in some sort of dialogue process. Just about the time of that deadline, April 15th, when Charles had said the Reformation people have until then to come back to school, just about then, the Latin, the revised Latin apology to the Augsburg Confession was published, put out with the first German or Latin German edition of the Augsburg Confession, and that apology in that edition appears over Melanchthon's signature alone. Very properly. About half a year later, just about at this time of the year 45, 450 years back, kind of freewheeling German version that came out, done by Jonas, but with the cooperation of Melanchthon. German doesn't always use the same words, usually more wordy than the Latin, but it usually faithfully reproduces the Latin thought. I can only recall one instance where I was somewhat bothered by a difference. It was writing something on conscientious objection, nuclear war, something of that sort. And looking up the confessional passages, he found there was one place where both the apology and Augsburg confession spoke of waging war, and the Latin apology simply said Bella Gerere. The German added the qualifying phrase Kriegs fürst und gemeinen Friedenswillen. I don't have to translate. Okay. But when you think it over, finally, similar statements are being made. The German is simply giving some additional information about what the wars are that are under consideration. Some place along the line, we'll have to get into this. What about the revision of the confession that we're talking about? You know, it's no secret that Melanchthon caused the Lutheran Church a lot of difficulty with his changes in his own writings, and most especially in changes in the confessional writings. Our church is the cornerstone of our churches today, still testify to that. They don't just say AC, but they have on their UAC, unaltered Augsburg Confession. You know, the glaring example of Article 10 in the Augustana, where what used to be the body and blood adsim and vestigio antur later on becomes body and blood exige antur, a much less precise term. And that's, of course, why Reformed people, even Calvin, could say, I subscribe to the Augsburg Confession in the sense, of course, of the author, the variata sense. But this is a little different situation. No Lutheran in his right mind, I think, would question Melanchthon's right to take that first draft, and work it over once he got the Constitution copy in his hand. That revision Melanchthon was obligated to make, and he made this full right. And once he got the copy, he could do the job better, and then he did. Another point to note, what Melanchthon had prepared at Augsburg was authorized by the responsible estates, but the emperor rejected it, and therefore the document fell by the wayside. And Melanchthon had every right to present another over his own signature. Once, of course, the revised apology was accepted, that's a new set of rules prevail, and there Melanchthon should have left off with his tinkering once the church had accepted the document or made only such changes as were authorized. He tells us himself that the 1540 apology edition was diligenter recognita, carefully revised. But this too should be said, that even these later apology revisions never had quite the damaging effect on the churches that the Augustana variata did. Now, how does this apology written at Wittenberg and published there in April 1531 by Melanchthon, over Melanchthon's signature, how does that get to be a confessional document? I think the highest compliment ever paid to the apology as a writing for the Lutheran Church is this spontaneous, prompt, enthusiastic, determined, uncoerced acceptance of the apology as a Lutheran confession. Immediately after it came out, people were saying, This is what we need. This is something good, as Spengler says. This will produce much good among our posterity. That means us in this room. Brandt says, dignum canone, worthy of the confessional canon. These are private persons, however. A year later, at the council at Schweinfurt between Romans and Catholics, between Romans and the Reformation people, the Reformation people made this apology, their very own confession, and said, it's ours as the defense and explanation of the Augsburg Confession. A debate arose there at Schweinfurt whether the title there be apology, meaning, of course, defense. The Romans said, you can't call it that. The best you can call it is assertio, your claim. But then the Reformation people responded, we named it Apologia, because it was presented to Charles after the confession. It is not impossible to omit this word. Apology is the correlate of the confession. Next year, Luther added the weight of his personal testimony, telling the people who were in difficulty in Leipzig to stand fast to our confession and apology. And the Wittenberg Concord recognized the apology. And at small call the next year, theologians unanimously agreed among themselves in all points and articles contained in our confession and apology. As the Reformation movement gained ground and more territories were added to it, each territory would have to determine what is going to be the doctrinal platform. And there is variation in these corpora doctrinae, these bodies, doctrines, confessional books, actually. Certain ones add this item, other ones omit it. But there's one common feature. They all have Augsburg Confession and apology. And even in the days when Melanchthon was troubling the church and under fire, there are no serious efforts to remove the apology from the corporate doctrinae. The high point, of course, is reached when you get your formula conquered. And we ought to probably hear that statement there. You know what? When the formulators are saying this is going to be our platform, they mention the different creeds. In the fourth place, as regards the proper and true sense of the oft-quoted Augsburg Confession, an extensive apology was composed and published in print in 1531. After the presentation of the confession, in order that we might explain ourselves at greater length and guard against the papists, and that condemned errors might not steal into the Church of God under the name of the Augsburg Confession, or dare to seek cover under the same. We unanimously confess this also, because not only is the said Augsburg Confession explained as much as is necessary and guarded, but also proven and confirmed by clear, irrefutable testimonies of the Holy Scriptures. Pope, when Ed Bragg of Fond du Lac, a town in which I used to live, seconded the nomination of Grover Cleveland to be the party's candidate for the presidency of the United States, and he eulogized this way, he couldn't say too much about Grover Cleveland's character, so he said this, we love him most for the enemies he has made. We could, paraphrase that and apply that to the apology, he appreciated very much just for the enemies it has made. And it has had its enemies from the very beginning, of course. I described the scene where Charles simply rejected the thing in total. The Melanchthon biographer, recent biographer, says of this opposition, the reaction of the Roman Catholics also testifies to the apology's significance. The Archbishop of Mainz forwarded a copy to Emperor Charles showing how the Christian religion was being destroyed. In Italy, it was so well received that even Papias himself was asked to write an answer. Actually, the Romans could have helped their own cause best if on September 22nd, if they had accepted the document presented there and prevented Melanchthon then from introducing these great improvements. Rome continued its efforts to sidetrack the apology. In the centennial year, 1631, the book that the Saxon theologians put out in honor of the occasion mostly these matters. A whole chapter in that book, it's chapter 37, incidentally, big book, treats the question of the apologia, der altvölkischen Konfession, auch im Religionsfrieden begriffen oder davon ausgeschlossen sei. This is the Augsburg religious piece. This question had to be answered because the Romans didn't want the apology to have any official recognition. I think the reason is obvious. The apology simply spells out the Roman problem in clear and unmistakable terms. The Reformed may declare for an altered Augsburg confession and have done so, but they aren't ready to yield to the more explicit real presence statements in Article 10 on the Lord's Supper and the apology. The apology has also been opposed by Lutherans. The best known, probably, instance is the notorious attack on the Lutheran confessions, usually just called American Lutheranism, and embodied in that paper, The Definite Platform, Doctrinal and Disciplinary, for Evangelical Lutheran District Synod. This anti-confessional movement, spearheaded by Gettysburg Schmucker in the mid part of the previous century, wanted to do extensive whittling and rewriting on the Augsburg Confession. And the other confession, it rejected. It rejected all the other symbolical books. Now that includes the apology. The excuse given for such exclusion of the apology and the other remaining confessions is indicated by this quotation from the Definite Platform. The extraordinary length of the other former symbolical books as a whole is sufficient reason for their rejection as a prescribed creed, even if all their contents were believed to be true. Because neither the scriptures nor the practice of the early centuries affords any warrant for an uninspired and therefore fallible creed nearly as large as the entire Old and New Testament together. The exaction of such an extended creed is subversive of all individual liberty of thought and freedom of scriptural investigation. The apology is long, seven times longer than the Augsburg Confession that it defends and explains. A confessional Lutheran, however, will regard that length as strength rather than weakness. He's not all that much interested in liberty of religious thought as is Schmucker. He'll regard that length as an opportunity for the writer in the apology to spell out in detail truths expressed in distilled embryonic form in the Augsburg Confession. who wrote this section on opposition. The worst opposition to the apology from Lutherans yesterday, today, and tomorrow, too, is the mass opposition of indifference and ignorance. Too much of that today. Too many Lutherans in the public ministry have at best only read the apology once, and then often only hastily and under compulsion. And we're getting into this fifth point, the apology as abiding assignment. We might begin with a random selection of tributes paid the apology by its friends and its foes. Philip Schaff, from the ranks of the Reformed, praises the apology scholarship. It is the most learned of the Lutheran symbols. It greatly strengthened the confidence of scholars in the cause of Protestantism. Its chief and permanent value consists in its being the oldest and most authentic interpretation of the Augsburg Confession by the author himself. H. E. Jacobs, an English translator, editor, commentator on the Apology, gives all Lutheran pastors and would-be pastors food for thought when he says, to one charged with the cure of souls, frequent reading of the Apology is invaluable on account of the manner in which it solves difficulties connected with the most vital points in Christian experience. While a private Christian, although perhaps compelled to pass by some portions occupied with learned discussion, will find many, we may say in most parts, that it is a book of practical religion. Now these two points of the apology, Schaff stresses the scholarship, and Jacobs, the pastoral concern. These two good attributes are hard enough to come by even when they are distinct from one another. The scholarly theologian is seldom a people's pastor, and the people's pastor is, by the same token, often not a scholarly theologian. It takes a bishop, a good bishop, to combine the roles. Melanchthon was that in composing for us the apology 450 years ago. We're moving into now, of course, the content. When he presented the apology's first draft to the emperor way back in September 1530, Chancellor Brick insisted that the document was both a defense and an interpretation of the Augsburg Confession. Those inclined to favor the Augsburg Confession alone to the exclusion of all the other confessions should take note of Brick's point. What is briefly stated in the Augustana is amplified in the Apology. What it appears in the Augsburg Confession as the end product, for that, the Apology supplies scriptural evidence and a methodical development. The Apology commentary on the Augustana Articles 7 and 8, dealing with the Church, is an excellent case in point. The most important point to be made in the matter of the content of the Apology and in its abiding assignment role has to do with the Apology's treatment, of course, of justification. Sola gratia, sola fide. On the few most important Reformation issues, the most important issue, the apology excels in treating the whole subject. About one-third of the whole apology is devoted to this subject of justification. Now, whether you count the material as one article, Article 4 on justification with love and the fulfilling of the law as a subpart, or whether you have two articles, each with their own number, doesn't make any difference. What matters is that this material be recognized, studied, and appreciated as the classic Lutheran treatment of that doctrinal area that is the Articulus Sanctus Evidentius, for the whole Church and for the single sinner. You probably all know Albrecht's studies. It's a good point that he makes. Melanchthon, as he himself says, a letter, worked hardest on the doctrine of justification by faith. His treatment of this doctrine constitutes virtually a third of the entire apology. He interpreted all other doctrines in its light. The apology, therefore, is a classic on justification and related doctrine. The related doctrine, in that quotation, reminds us that Melanchthon, in his treatment of justification and the apology, actually wove together four related subjects of the Augsburg Confession: justification, ministry, new obedience, and good works. This points out the truth that he interpreted all other doctrines in the light of the doctrine of justification. That's Lutheranism at its best. 450 years ago, and that's still Lutheranism at its best in this year. And it will be Lutheranism at its best also in your case, hopefully. If the question were raised, what is the most important, useful, single apology quotation, the answers would certainly be as various and manifold as would be the people answering the question. My answer would be Apology, Article 4, portion of 48, where it is asserted that faith is to assent to the promise of God, in which, for Christ's sake, the remission of sins and justification are freely offered. Those few words say it all, and then some. That's a word to teach the recent convert, the young beginner. It's still the word for the trained pastor and the veteran believer on his deathbed. This is the point that the apology most emphatically makes: the heart and essence of your abiding assignment. You will recall or want to bring to mind too that the word of that old historian Seckendorf. No one can be truly called a theologian of our church who has not diligently and repeatedly read the apology or familiarized himself with it. Our abiding apology assignment is to read the apology diligently and repeatedly throughout our ministry. The Lord will bless you in that ministry when and insofar as you busy yourself in it with the preaching and teaching the truth that the apology brings forth. And in that sense, the apology is 450 years old, but is still new and compelling, and will be that also throughout your ministry.
I hope you're convinced with me that my words of introduction were not superfluous. I would also like to have you recall the words of President Bowman when he occupied this lectern very recently, underscoring the fact that we do indeed need to restudy the doctrine of justification. And I think Professor Frederick has really pointed us into that same direction, which I hope then will now elicit some questions and some comments and responses from our group. We do have a few moments to do so.
Dr. Frederick, would you like to comment on the apparent blind spot a lot of scholars have when they discuss Augsburg Confession 7? They never seem to realize that Melanchthon also wrote a section in the apology on much of the same.
Well, Well, let's be kind and call it wishful thinking. That's the point. You praise the Augsburg Confession, and you forget about the rest of it, because that is too explicit. It pins you down. And I say, in kindness, we'll say, maybe forgetfulness, whatever. But that's the problem. We're in a kind of a difficult position. You know, we don't ever want to say the Augsburg Confession isn't any good, you know. We can't say that. And we have to agree it's the primary confession, the one that has been most useful in the history of the Church. We have to agree with all these things. And somehow we aren't getting our point across that there is an apology. You just have to compare last year and all the celebration of the confession, and nobody begrudges at that. There could have been more of the right kind, and then compare that with this year or with 3 years back during the Concord. They don't get much play because they just are, well, they're too confined for this present time. I don't know. I haven't heard of any other attention being paid to the apology this year besides this little attention we're giving it here this morning. I don't know of any. Do you?
Fort Wayne did.
They did, yeah.
Any other comments, please?
Your initial that the whole summation was that we came to Augsburg saying we are a part of the Church. They published their confutation and said, no, you're not. And we turned right around and said, with our apology, yes, we indeed are. And then the whole focus of Lutheranism itself is merely we don't want to be separate from the rest of you. And then you somewhat alluded to the Roman Catholic Lutheran discussions that were a big thing a year ago, but also seem to have died now. It seems like in our church especially, we're having a difficult time trying to define church and ministry. And that seems to me to be what exactly the apology and the Augsburg Confession were trying to do for Rome back then. I'm wondering if you might be able to give us some sort of sense of direction that we might try, rather than fencing ourselves off, maybe using the confession as a seed box, something to keep right and salutary at the moment.
Well, I think these first two questions have something in common. I think that they're the best effort we can put forth would be in this direction of creating an awareness of the value of seeing the apology. We're talking about that one especially. An awareness for the Augsburg Confession. I think this was something along that line was accomplished last year when it wasn't sidetracked into this general, you know, let's be friends and this kind of thing. I recall one good result that came the previous year. Remember that, you know, when they first announced the discussions about the Augsburg Confession between Romans and Lutherans, that a good cardinal over in Italy said, I think that's a good idea. Why doesn't somebody send me a copy of the Augsburg Confession? I'd like to take a look at it, you know. Well, he's 450 years late, but if he starts looking now, maybe some good will be done. Rather than putting the apology back on the shelf maybe after next year, keep working it, keeping it alive, keeping it before us and then also where we came before others. That's, I think, the way to go.
I have a question.
my guess. I think some zealous Jesuit in Spain burned it. I don't know. I can't prove that, but...
Do you think maybe it's, they haven't brought the catalog in yet?
Oh, it could be. It could be found someday, you know. I recall recently a lecture by Overman, the Syrian man, where he related the incident just before he came to this country on that lecture tour. He had been looking around in the archives and came across a letter that Melanchthon had written home from Augsburg. You know, nobody had ever seen it before. It was real interesting. And it shows you maybe one of these reasons why Melanchthon was missing that meeting on August 3rd when the Constitution was read. He was very busy. And this time he and one or two others were invited to a big dinner by a burgher of Augsburg. We had the idea if we could just, you know, get these people together and talk a little bit, we can help the cause. So he had a couple of Lutherans on one side of the table and some Romans on the other. And then when the Langton is describing all this, when the prayer was to be said, the host turned to Langton and said, give us prayer. And from the other side of the table came the objection, I didn't know that those Reformation people prayed. Well, that kind of put a damper on the meeting. This just shows you that there's probably we'll find the answer to some of these questions someday. It's going on all the time.
Yeah, the Latin version, the German version, I think, was it two,
Robert Schultz recently wrote an article showing how the Augsburg Confession was written to show how the Lutherans were conforming to the Code of Justinian. Do you feel that Melanchthon had the same idea in mind when he wrote the apology?
Well, you had me at a distance. Yeah. Okay, did you hear the question over there?
Okay.
Well, I don't know. There's going to be much of an answer. You have me at a disadvantage. I don't know this article.
If you're in the 15th century journal, either a year or 3 years ago, but he tried to show how Melanchthon wrote the Augsburg Confession to conform to the Court of Justinian in showing that they were, in fact, Catholic in their faith. I mean, Catholic with a small c. And I was wondering if
you noticed
the apology was written in a similar vein.
Well, I can't respond about the article, but this, of course, is Melanchthon's intention all the way along the line, that what we're saying is what the church had said. And you people got off the track. Of course, that's the tone that runs through all of the confessions. That's why Kenneth hooked those testimony on there as to the final pastors saying, we're with the old position of the church. You are the one who has departed. Of course, that's the great historical debate in Germany in the 19th century. Ranke says that's the way it was, and Dallinger says, no, the Reformation is a departure again. So it's a big question, and I'm sure this is the point that Melanchthon is making.
Professor Frederick, one bit of information you did not share with us, and I wonder if you would comment, where was Luther during that whole time when Melanchthon was having dinner parties and meeting with the 3 and 3 and the 10 and 10 and so forth?
It was a miserable time for him. He'd been in the forefront, and there he had it set 30 miles, that's about it, 30 miles away. And still, while this is all going on at Coburg, and he gets real mad when he gets reports. You know, when he hears the claim of August 3rd that the Confutation has repudiated or rejected and destroyed the Augsburg Confession,
he says, they lie like reprobates, if they make a claim like that, and he's human all the time, and very, very much concerned. I should know the total of Luther letters that went to Augsburg. Maybe you know that, Hilton. But it's a surprisingly large number of letters that Luther sent to Augsburg, both to Melanchthon and to many others. So he's watching the scene very closely.
And as soon as they pick him up at Coburg on the way home, he starts taking over again.
Any other questions you would like to raise? One conversation earlier this morning, Professor Frederick, dealt with a revival of the use of the apology or redivivus or whatever term you'd like to use. I wonder if you could speak a little more on how, from the practical point of view, you think this could be accomplished without becoming judgmental. It seems to me that Lutheranism has almost emulated the period of about 150, 160 years ago, when the Lutheran confessions were almost totally ignored. We are approaching that kind of situation if we haven't already gotten to it. What can we today do to reinstill a greater knowledge of and a greater love for our Lutheran symbols?
Well, I know where I'm going to start. For instance, with the apology or Formula of Concord, you know, I hope I can get it to this point that students will dig themselves into these documents willingly, eagerly, and then go on from there. But it is a bad thing that we have this lack of acquaintance even with the documents. We have better means at our disposal now to bring this before people. We have all these films and all these devices that we can use to get them interested, and yet we have a long, long way to go on that. I don't know what the answer is.
Publication, it's probably a continuing task that will never really completely accomplish.
I think one way to do it is get your students to outline the policy.
wouldn't try that.
I think we've reached the area of sufficiency. Seeing no more hands raised, and again, Professor Frederick, we want to express our real deep appreciation to you for appearing in our midst today and to give us this most fascinating lecture and also to field these questions. I know that sometimes that's not the easiest thing to do when you see this very highly intelligent group sitting in front of you. So again, many, many thanks. We appreciated your presentation and your presence.
It's been a pleasure being here. Keep on asking the questions. Had I been at home, I would have permitted you to interrupt anyway along the line. I think that's a good sign, especially when the questions are hard and indicate that you're working on the subject.